Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So, Guy, Nick Mason, Sourceful of Secrets, of which we are two-fifths, right? We're going back out on the road in the summer across the UK.
We are. It's all of June, so brace yourself.
What's it called?
It's called the Set the Control Tour. What a brilliant name. Who do you think could have come up with such a great name for a tour, Gary?
I wonder. I think I'm looking at him, right? But then I did come up with Nick Mason, Sourceful of Secrets.
You did, and in fact, that came up in a podcast then because you were inspired by Woody Woodman's U-Boat, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Anyway, but enough of that.
So, join Nick, Guy, Lee Harris, Don Beacon, and me as we celebrate the early years with, you know, that incredible, it's an incredible body of work, isn't it? The early Pink Floyd. It goes up to just before Dark Side of the Moon.
Goes up to 1972, with all the film soundtracks, all the Sid stuff you've never heard, stuff that no one's ever heard, frankly.
Obviously.
Echoes is the big sort of, you know, what is that? What would you call it?
Magnum opus.
Yeah, I love a Magnum, don't you?
Yeah, I never met Magnum. Anyway, tickets are on sale now and you can buy yours at myticket.co.uk.
And Kilimanjaro Live presents Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, the Set the Control Tour.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. So what I wanted to talk to you about today briefly was I was having dinner with my family in Soho the other night on Dean Street and we started to walk home and then I said, well, I must show you something. So I told them, I dragged them down St. Anne's Court, is it? I forget the name of that street. It's that little tiny street that runs between Wardour and Dean. And because I wanted to show them Trident Studios.
Oh, right. Yes, of course.
So I said, you know, in this studio, you know, this is where, you know, Spandau, we recorded all our early backing tracks for the first album. Electric Warrior, T-Rex was recorded. Elton John recorded in here. And David Bowie did Ziggy Stardust, Space Oddity in here. So I dragged them down. They were completely uninterested.
Of course
they were. And I saw the plaque. And there's a plaque above. And all it says is Ziggy Stardust was recorded here, right? So you think, well, that's just not enough. You know, that's not enough. And if you go to down Wardour Street and you look to where the marquee was, the plaque above the marquee just says Keith Moon played here.
That's right, yeah.
What is that? Why is that?
I don't know, because obviously the Keith Moon estate got there first. I don't know, out of everyone.
And lobbied.
Yeah, no, just say this was the marquee. I mean, surely that's enough.
Or put a nice brass plaque up. That's like you've got outside your house.
Well, exactly. And like with a QR code, which takes you to a site. No, but then it has a list of everyone who ever played the marquee. I don't know. Do you know
I mean, around the corner from that, Old Compton Street is another blue plaque, and that is, that's above a chip shop now, and that says the Two Eyes.
The Two Eyes, there you go.
Was there. So, I mean, you know, there is a Spandau blue plaque. That isn't the reason I just chose to talk about
that. I think it
that
is, but yeah, go on.
On this intro. I mean, this is a genuine problem I'm having here, that the marquee just says Keith Moon.
No, that is
the
weird.
Studio
of all
just
the
says Ziggy Stardust. Right?
Yeah.
You know, and
what you're saying is that you've got places which where the history and the provenance is about the place, and they've been reduced to events.
Yeah,
or in one case,
you could say the Who, Bowie. You know, I mean, Yardbirds. You could say them all played.
No, exactly. Right? No, just say the marquee. Legendary. I mean,
legendary.
Yeah.
And then look it up on Wikipedia. Or just have a Wikipedia address.
Yeah, this is sounding like something we sound to old duffers, sort of writing to a letter with, "Dear Sir."
Yes.
You know, we're sort of.
Anyway, I wanted to take my boys, but they couldn't be interested. They wanted to go home and get an ice cream or something like that. Round to the Blitz on Great Queen Street.
Ah, there we go.
So aptly named, isn't it, Great Queen Street?
So aptly, because of course it was then also. Also, it's where Brown's was, wasn't it?
It was. And where there is a blue plaque.
And Zanzibar.
There is a blue plaque. I'm trying to get this across.
Yeah, got four.
Which says Spandau Ballet played here first December the 5th, 1979.
We
do you have a blue plaque?
All that. No, I have plaque.
I was just waiting for you. Apparently, you have to be dead to have a proper blue plaque. So hurry up.
Yeah. No, I'm on noted things. I'm on a few noted things. I want a noted thing that happened this week, in fact.
Tell me.
Which was what? I don't know if you heard, but Well, David Gilmour released his first record for 9 years yesterday, didn't he?
I've heard it. Yeah. And it's fantastic. And you're on it.
I am on it.
I got confused because Steve Gadd's apparently in the video, but he's not on that track.
Yeah, he is.
Is he?
Steve's on
it. Is that Steve's track?
Yeah, that's Steve Gadd played. No, he played the whole album.
Did he?
Well, apart from there's one or two songs, I can't, which is Adam Betts and Tom Herbert playing bass. But yeah.
Because if you go to the credits on Apple for the song, your name's on it, but not Steve's.
Oh, I'm sure. No, because we did it. I did it with him.
But the track's great. Is. And your bass sounds wonderful, I have to
Thank
say.
You. Although I've got to say, I was going to point out, there's two basses on it. One of them, which isn't really a bass part, it's more of a tenor, is actually David playing a Hofner violin bass. But in my defence, it was on there before I played on it. So it's not like he had to
and
come
you
up
just
with something.
And you just couldn't make it any better than that.
No, right? No, it's not a bass part. It's just like a lovely David melodic
Maybe that's the bit I really
part.
Like, that I sent you a text over saying how wonderful it was.
I dare say it is.
But no, I mean, you must be excited with the album.
Really, really excited. It's
and
great.
That, but is this the one with Rick on?
That track hasn't got Rick on. No, the track with Rick is amazing. And it is something. It was after the 2006 tour.
Rick Wright, we're talking Rick about. Rick Wright,
yeah. After the tour, which had been so great, and it was very much about, you know, that was such a great thing, because that tour was so much about David and Rick and this musical partnership. And David had such a good time that he actually set up a barn at his farm for us to go and record him for a week. And we just went and we just jammed for a week. And he had managed, there's one track, he managed to get out of it and he managed to sort of write the other bits. And he found bits of Rick's keyboards from other things to stick on the other bits.
Wow.
So there's a whole, I mean, it's incredibly moving. Obviously, you know, Rick was my father-in-law, my son's grandfather. So it's very, very emotional for me. So there's a whole song with Rick on it.
Oh,
and it's me playing bass, and most of my bass is the original bass. So it's us playing along with him.
So some of that was used on the Endless River, wasn't it?
Yeah,
Floyd. Yeah, yeah.
No, it wasn't. No, no. The Endless River stuff was from the Division Bell sessions. That wasn't from David's thing.
Keep up, Bond.
Yeah, really.
Oh my God. I'm assuming somewhere in Sheffield there must be a blue plaque for Def Leppard. I would have thought.
Well, I don't know. Maybe there's. Maybe that it will just be for one of them or.
Or ABC or Human League or... I mean, they've had a few. Richard Hawley, I mean, it goes on. Sheffield's bred a lot of rock musicians.
It's a lot of rock. Well, and a lot of electro musicians. Yeah. You know, there's Sheffield's kind of really punches, not above its weight, actually, because it's the fourth biggest city in Britain. So it should have a heritage, shouldn't it?
Yeah. You should do one of those sort of BBC 4 train things for you.
Well, this
Facts
is basically
like
my
that.
Stepping
really
stone
sexy,
to that.
Aren't they?
Is that I'm the Michael Portillo of rock and roll.
Yeah. You know, I'm excited about getting Joe on again because I know we had him on a few years ago, and I think we hardly spoke about Def Leppard. We just spoke about all of music. He is such an aficionado.
He's brilliant. He's a walking pub quiz, that man. Yeah. And I'm excited because I've never met him in the flesh.
Haven't you?
No, only on Zoom.
I hope you're looking smart. Have you chosen the right clothes? You're not wearing leathers. I thought you might do that.
Well, neither are you.
Should we get him on?
Welcome to the Rock On Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience? When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
I love the fact he's dancing to it naked. Like, it's so hedonistic. It's so liberating. How brilliant.
We knew the moment that the five of us were in a room, like the first three chords, was like, oh, we finally all found each other.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
He started playing that as his main guitar. So it was his main guitar, so I just said, you can have it.
Thank you, guys, for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Everyone in the band was completely disengaged from their partners while we made Rumours.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
The Rock On Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking! Ah!
So this morning, Joe, I took my 12-year-old on a school run and I played the Hunky Dory to him. I just felt almost like I'd forgotten that album. That it was actually like, it was like songwriting demos, weren't they? Really?
It was Bowie doing the folk thing, I suppose. I've just spent probably the last 6 months diving in and out on piano, learning to play all side one on piano.
Really?
Literally started off with Changes, which goes into the
Pretty
Light Poem, which
Eight
goes into Life on Mars, which goes into Quicksand.
Did you learn Life on Mars on piano?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because I've mentioned this before, sorry, but my son actually did that for his grade 6 exam piece.
Oh, good for him.
But it's so you're clearly grade 6 at least.
No, grade 1. But, you know, I can fake it with a beer or two.
What tracks does Bowie play on? Or is it all Rick Wakeman?
Rick Wakeman plays on most of it. I think Bowie mimed it on
the old Grey Whistle Test.
But yeah. I do believe if Bowie played on anything, he might have played on
8-line poem, maybe.
Yeah, because it's so simplistic. If I can do it, he could. he may have also played on Oh You Pretty. I know he definitely played on Oh You Pretty Thing, the Peter Noone version. If you ever hear that, that's Bowie on piano.
Because I was thinking about that this morning, actually. Joe, we're talking about Bowie because we all love Bowie. I mean, when you were on before, 3 years ago or something now, we ranted on about Bowie for so long, didn't we? So we might as well continue.
Of course.
But I was thinking this morning, listening to that song, Oh, You Pretty Things, that when Peter Noone did it, it was kind of judgmental.
It was... Look at these crazy, you know, I guess you'd call them.
I love the fact that he legally had to, you know, to get airplay, being Peter Noone, had to change the lyrics to Another's a Bitch. It was Another's a Beast. He changed Bitch to Beast.
But it was.
And he just made it sound like Des O'Connor.
Where when Bowie sings it, it's like, this is about one of my gang.
Yeah.
This is.
Yes, he wasn't just. Yeah, he was. Yeah, Peter Noone was the teacher, and Bowie was the naughty pupil with the.
Do you know what? I haven't listened to it for years. I can't actually remember it. Sorry.
I'm not going to sing it. It's tempting to sing it right now. But
you can't remember the song, or you can't remember Peter Noone's version?
No, I remember the song. I can't remember Peter Noone's version. I didn't research it because I thought we were talking to you.
Yeah. No, actually, I am Peter Noone.
Wait a minute.
He's still alive. He's still around. We should talk about Def Leppard, of course.
Oh, and, really?
No. Peter Noone. Let's go Peter Noone.
I'm happy to talk about Peter Noone all day. Don't know anything about him, except he sells CDs on TV in America now.
Does he?
You know those adverts when there's him and... There's a guy and a girl that used to be in the Mamas and the Papas or something. There's Peter Noone and some girl that used to be in something. And they're selling this 6-CD box set. And it's just so sycophantically presented. It's hilarious.
What, of his music?
No, everybody's like, hey, do you remember this one?
And they'll play a little bit of the Turtles
or, you know, Florida Idiots or something like that. And then, hey, yes, Peter, I remember that one. And what about this one?
Was he part of the beat? Sort of movement.
They were full on British Invasion.
Yeah.
I remember the Who's first big tour of America was supporting Herman's Hermits. Mm-hmm. The famous Keith Moon story and the car and the swimming pool and everything was on tour with Herman's Hermits.
Yeah, it's as mad as it sounds. They were actually bigger than
the Kinks. Thinking about it, just one other story on this while we're still digressing.
You're going to be saying that.
While we're still digressing. The thing I didn't know the other week but read was that when Eddie Cochran died in the car crash... when they were going to the airport. And he used to play a big Gretsch guitar, Eddie Cochran, right? Come on, everybody.
Yes, he did.
Or he the car had the guitar in it and the policeman turned up and he took the guitar to the police station and he apparently taught himself on Cochran's guitar. Cochran's dead now. He then formed a band himself and he was Dave D from Dave D, Dozy, Beaker, Mick and Titch.
You're joking.
No.
Wow.
It sounds. But I used to think there were six people in Dave D, Dozy, Beaky, Mick, and Titch. Oh, but it's not. It's Dave D.
Dave, yeah, no comma. See? That's right. You would say punctuation. It's a different. Or capitalization.
I always thought he sounded like a copper.
Yeah. But you know what they say about capitalization, never mind punctuation? It's the difference between helping your Uncle Jack off a horse or helping your Uncle Jack off a horse.
Okay, please, Def Leppard, right now.
Well, so, Dave D came to see us at the Retford Porterhouse.
When he was the Retford Porterhouse.
Did he nick you? He was an A&R man for EMI.
That's right, he was.
I sat after we'd finished our performance. You've got to remember the Retford Porterhouse stage is half the size of this room. So there's and it's got a big mirrored pillar.
No, I've played it, and someone's guitar caught fire because the stage was so small. When they lent it up against one of the lights, and it caught fire.
Absolutely brilliant. So you know, you do what you can. This big pole holding the ceiling up is right where the singer should be standing. So you're kind of dancing around the thing all night. And we did our gig, and there's 11 A&R men in because this is just before we signed our deal, like July of 79. And we finished, and we, you know, in the days when you could go and have a drink at the bar in the venue you're playing at, I sat down and Dave D sat next to me and he just turned around and went, you don't move much for a singer, do you?
He was looking at the pole.
Yeah. So I I'd had a few beers by then, so I turned around and told him to, which I won't say out loud, because he was rather large at the time. And that was us not signing to EMI.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Brilliant.
Do you know, we should actually, why don't we just start with a little bit of this? Because I listened back to the episode you did, which is so brilliant, and we talk about all kind. I think I said it in the end of it. There'd never been more bands mentioned in one episode other than when you were on, because you're such an oracle of pop and rock music. Amazing. But we completely missed how you guys became Def Leppard and how you ever got together. And, you know, we had you in clubs when you were younger going to see bands, and then we sort of jumped to mega albums.
Right. Okay.
And I don't know that story.
Let's go into the middle. But, well, it's an often told story, but it's worth telling again. the reason that we got together was, you know the movie Sliding Doors, right? You've seen Sliding Doors, where if you go through the door, your life goes a certain way, and if you miss the tube,
you turn into Gwyneth Paltrow.
You go back home and you catch your wife in bed with another bloke. You know, that kind of thing. I was a regular walking from my factory job up to the 400 yards to the bus stop, but in between there was a newsagent, and it's Thursday night, which is the day that all the you know, sounds, melody maker, all that, like, come out. So I go in to get one, because Thursday's also payday, and you get some chewing gum.
You have to be an NME man, right?
And oh God, I hated the NME.
Did you?
Because I was a rocker.
But I thought it was Charles Shaw Murray was like the voice of Bowie in
NME. He probably was, but actually, he also hated everything else that I liked.
Sounds didn't actually become metal rock until you came along. In fact,
I liked disc. I thought Record Mirror disc was, you know, disc. And then they
quite an outlier there.
I was not a big fan of the NME, because they hated everything. Because me and you are very similar, but we're like the letter Y. We're exactly the same until it gets here, and then. Your love of soul and like, say, Northern Soul, whatever, overtook my rock thing.
Rock was dead in NME after punk, wasn't it? Totally. Rockist, you were rockist.
But anyway, so I'm pulling into I walk into the newsagent, and I dawdle over, I don't know, oh, look, wow, Clash album's coming out, or whatever it was in 77. And as I walk out the shop, the bus, the number 9 bus, that I catch at 5:02 every night, is gone. And it goes sailing up the hill. So now I've got to walk home, which is no big deal. It's August. It's a lovely night. But it's a real steep hill. And I don't know why, but there's a parallel road 400 yards to the right. And I walked up that one for some reason. I don't know. I saw somebody and I went over to talk to him, and I thought, I'm near, I'll go up that way. So I walked up this more, you know, a less walked road, if you like.
The road less travelled.
Indeed. And coming down it is Pete Willis, the original Def Leppard guitarist, who I would not have seen had I caught the bus. And I just bought this 30 quid Black Les Paul copy from a music store, a second-hand shop on London Road in England, in Sheffield. And I wanted, you know, I'd seen Eddie and the Hot Rods, or whichever punk band has allowed themselves to go on Top of the Pops, Generation X. And then, you know, you're looking at him going, I could do that if they can. Because half it's just two chords and some, you know, anger. And I saw him and I knew he played guitar. And I said, do you want to get a band together? Because I just got this guitar. And he went, I knew him a bit. I had a friend who was a friend of his, so I didn't know him, but I knew of him. And he said, nah, he says, I've kind of got one. We're looking for a singer. And I just went, I'll do it.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you know you were a singer?
Excitable utterance, as they'd call it in court. No, well, I used to sing in a choir. I wrote my first song when I was 8, after my mom taught me 4 chords, which I realised was 10,000 songs, depending on which way around you do them.
Basically all of them, yeah.
And I got, you know, I just got into straight away writing my own stuff. So I was writing songs at 8, but I sounded like a little, you know, like a little boy, as nothing's dropped yet.
You sounded like Ian Gillan.
I sounded more like Jimmy Osmond, actually. You know, and then, like most kids, you know, Wimbledon comes along and you get a tennis racket, and the Open comes on, you get a golf club, and the football season starts, you're playing football. So I kept getting distracted, but I always came back to music in the evenings. That's what I did.
Oh, we said you get a tennis racket. And I thought you meant for miming guitar.
Jumping over the fence and playing on the university courts before you got kicked off. And then I went back into music. When I was 15 or 16, I just went headlong into music. But by then, it was 7 years since I wrote my first song, so there was a lot of catching up to do.
But so you're not seeing yourself as a singer, you're seeing yourself as a guitarist and songwriter?
I just saw myself as somebody, I was like Cat Stevens, just strumming along and singing melodies over my own chords. It's the only way I knew. I couldn't really sing other people's music very well.
So when you went into, did you go into the rehearsal? Who was there?
Well then, once I said I'd do it, he said, oh, all right then, so I'll bring the guy. I said, come to my house And we'll have a meeting.
Did you have an amp? Did you?
No, I mean, this was an acoustic. I wasn't even going to be. I still had an acoustic, but that's all I had. And again, I got the electric, which I didn't have an amp to plug it into, so I don't know why I bought it. I was probably working my way towards getting an amp, you know. But it was Pete Willis, Rick Savage, and Tony Kenning was the original drummer. So it was only the three of them. They'd come out of this school band called Atomic Mass. And the singer was going to Manchester University, so they kind of imploded, you know. But the rest of them wanted to carry on. And then I came along, I suppose. And they were really... I think I only got the job for three reasons. They saw my record collection and went, wow, because it was pretty intense and very varied. Yes, I had Bowie, T-Rex, and what was going on at the time, Bebop Deluxe, as well as the punk stuff. But I also had Peter Gabriel and you know, probably Kate Bush by then, first album. I mean, I was very varied on what I liked, Supertramp. I mean,
What was the music in that collection that would have given the rest of your career away?
UFO. AC/DC, UFO, Montrose.
Motorhead?
Not really. I don't think they'd really happened to us by then.
No, still.
Pete Willis was really big on the David Live album because he preferred Earl Slick to Mick Ronson.
Wow.
Good guy though, Slicky, in fairness. Gave me a guitar once. But that was a good moment later on because once they'd been up to my house, I was tall and very enthusiastic. So I'd been in the band 6 weeks before I even sang a note. So there was no audition. It was just four kids that are now not on the street anymore, actively looking for a rehearsal room. And we were well aware that most bands in the Sheffield region that were either like us or established but playing the clubs, they used to rent the room over the pub for a two-hour rehearsal and hung all their gear up and play and then get kicked out and hung it all back down again. We wanted somewhere like this where we could get in, lock the door and leave it set up forever. And we found that at the Spoon Factory. We got the top floor for £5 a week. It was Portland Works, but it's where they used to make cutlery. And it was what
Sheffield Steel.
Yeah, Little Mesters, where it's one guy got a machine the size of that Hammond organ and he'd just do this all day and a spoon would come out of the bottom and he'd make another one. And then what happened was they could make 10,000 for the price of one Sheffield made in Sheffield spoon in China. So people started ordering that and it just incinerated. There was no Sheffield steel industry anymore. So they all started closing down. But the guys that owned these places wanted to rent them out to anybody. And if it was a rock band, they didn't care because we could make as much noise as we want. It's in the middle of nowhere. You know, it's 200, 300 yards from Bramall Lane, but there was no house.
But rehearsing in a steel factory. I mean, Springsteen would pay for that, wouldn't
he? Yeah, it wasn't a factory in the sense like the one I worked in, which was a true six-story thing. This was a real Victorian dump hole. I mean, it was a grotty, snotty, shitty little place. But it's perfect for a band in 1977.
Can I say, you must have had a good Saturday job to be able to buy all those records as well, though.
I had four paper rounds before I left school, and that's where I got most of my records from. And then when I started working at Osborne's, I was on £8 a week. And, you know, albums were still only about £2.50 by then. Yeah. So I gave my mum £5 a board. By the time I got it, I just had to give her a board, £5. So that left me £3. And if I walked to work or the bus was only 2p, I could just about afford to buy one pint a week and an album a week.
Of course, albums were cheaper than gigs.
I had to give half of my
Saturday job money to my mum. That's what my dad made me do that.
It didn't do us any harm, did it? You know.
So go on, carry on.
So we were 6 weeks. Eventually, Tony, the drummer, found this rehearsal place and we worked out it was going to cost us £125 each a week. It's like, oh, can I easily afford that? So we went down there and we cleaned it as best we could, and we found an old couch dumped out on the street, and we brought it in. God knows what was living in it, but we had a couch, and we brought a kettle and a record player, and there was a table in there, and then we eventually some old Afghan rugs, kind of like this, but mankier, and then we just set up, and we painted the walls and brought a few. I remember we had a poster.
But that must have been brilliant, isn't it?
Peter Gabriel's first. There's a poster advertising Peter Gabriel's first album where he's wearing an American football helmet.
Oh, yeah.
And we had that on the wall. And there was an article about Van Halen that had been taken out of the middle pages of sounds plastered up there with David Lee Roth bent in half, like an Olympic athlete, you know. And a few other things. We had some Bowie pictures and T-Rex, maybe. I can't remember. Queen.
Inspiration.
Just things to cover up holes on the wall more than anything else. And we started making a noise. You know, the first thing we did was we I had to borrow the old singer's microphones. Didn't have one.
Because before you got the drummer, have you not made any noise yet?
No. Right. We were literally got to know each other as mates. Right. It's like now, no pressure, but now you got to sing. And we were going to do Stairway to Heaven because you did in 77, didn't you? Until the guitar shops put the signs up saying you can't. And I couldn't do it. I was singing it like an octave down. It sounded like the, you know, there's a lady who saw it or something like that. You know, it's like an old coward. And Sav was like going, nah, it's time that. I said, can we do something I know?
He says, save that for the Rick Rubin album. You're going to do it 50 years' time.
And I said to Sav, I don't know this song that well. I had to listen to the record because I didn't know Led Zeppelin. Didn't have an older brother that was in. I was into T-Rex.
Oh, that's interesting.
So
that's
Zeppelin,
really interesting.
Sabbath, most of Deep Purple, except for the singles, was not my thing. Only because the situation of neighbourhood friends weren't into that. So I didn't, you know, it wasn't on daytime radio.
So you could have gone the other way in the wild.
Oh, could have gone. Listen, if they'd have all been into the Human League, I'd have been wearing a skinny tie now.
That's because you were aware
about
of all
Kraftwerk.
That,
You know what I mean? So we start. I said, can we do something that we all know? And then we just start name dropping songs. And I said, what about something like Bowie, like Suffragette City? And Gus Pete knew the Earl Slick version from David Live. He went, yeah, I can do that. Tony knew it. Sav could pretty much follow it. So my audition actually was Suffragette City. The first thing I sang, stood up into a microphone.
Hang on, you've gone through all that. And then you're going to do an audition. You've painted the place up. And,
I think it's a good job I actually kind of passed. Or I think they only kept me out of, like, you know, kind of, they felt sorry for me because he's been here. He's helped us decorate the place. We might as well keep
The work on the skirting board was great, but
there was nobody else, though. That was the thing, you know. I was the only...
But you say, you talk about you could have gone one way and they were definitely another way. So, you know, Sheffield, like all those towns in those days, was split into tribes, wasn't it?
Totally. It was really funny. I mean...
Well, yeah, it was very electro as a town, wasn't it?
Broomhill, where I was from, there's a record shop. It's still there now, and it's really big on Record Store Day. It's called The Record Collector. And regularly, I would be in there, and I'd be flicking through the stuff, and I'd turn and go, oh, hi, mate. And it was what's his name from Human League?
Oh, Phil Oakey.
Phil Oakey, yeah. You know, with long hair on one side, short on the other.
So it was always
and
like
we're
that.
Both, like, trying to grab this Mick Ronson album. And again, it's like I said, it's the why. He grew up listening to T-Rex, Bowie... Probably not so much Slade, not so much Sweet, but maybe Brown Paper Bagged It, like we all did Crazy Horses by the Osmonds. You know, great rock song, I'll be the first to say.
First single, pretty much, yeah.
And, you know, then he also loved, more than I did, say, Kraftwerk or Can, or, you know, maybe even the Stooges, which I actually did like the Stooges, but they were a bit too...
I love that you both made an album called Hysteria as
well. And both covered Only After Dark by Mick Ronson.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's a pub quiz question. The three things that we've got in common.
Amazing, isn't it? You can't get
Hysteria,
cigarette paper between you, really, can you?
And covering the same Mick Ronson song.
Wow.
And so, you know, I would see him in the record store occasionally. And then, of course, it starts to, you know... The local paper is the one that really
Martin
spreads.
Fry and, you know,
yeah, there's Martin Fry. Yeah. There's in Chesterfield. There's the Thompson twins. So you've got ABC. You've got the Thompson twins. You've got there was Charles Autry in the Deaf Aids, were one man. Clock DVA. Who else was the Human League? Heaven
Comsat.
17.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know.
Were they Sheffield Comsat? No, they.
Yeah, the Comsat Angels. Yeah.
It's such an amazing place for music. Right? I mean, Richard Hawley's been on the show as well.
Yeah, Pulp came along a bit later on. We opened for the Human League at the Limit Club. It was one of these. It's called a free festival. It always made me laugh.
Worst loading in Britain, that place, wasn't it? With the sheer drop right at the back of the club, wasn't it? To get in.
Well,
yeah,
it was like it was actually very much like what I think the Cabin was like. You came down all the stairs to get in, and then it was just one long room. And if there was a fire, you were all going to die. There's no other way out, you know. But they used to put this thing on once a month called Free Festival, which always made me laugh because it always made me think of Bowie.
Memory of a Free Festival.
But it was just, they let everybody in for nothing. So it was guaranteed full, but you didn't get paid. So it was costing you 35 quid to rent a van.
You were
and
on
all
the bill
stuff.
With Human League. I mean, it was
a Human League, us, Molodoy, and some other band.
Were you called Def Leppard?
Is this at the Limit Club?
Yeah, but they spelt the name wrong. Oh, you know, they always do.
Because I've got... Yeah. I'm sorry, but I've got one memory of playing at the Limit Club.
Who with?
This was with Funkapolitan. And I was trying to shout up this girl afterwards and feeling really stupid. And I just said, so what do you do? And it's just something I'll never forget. It's when I make parts for army radios in workshop.
Oh. But that sounds like a John Betjeman poem.
Yeah, it actually does. Really, that's the best pickup line I've ever heard.
We've got to steer our way really kind of like quickly, I guess, towards hysteria. But before then, Pyromania. Before then, there was definitely... You were definitely part of a new scene of metal, weren't you?
I suppose so.
Was AC/DC really the thing that really changed
it? No, not at all.
Because it's funny, because I saw AC/DC live at the Marquee. Loved it. I went every week. They did a residency for a month. My brother and I just loved it. And then you talk about the why going that way. But it was the showmanship of that band.
Yeah. I have an issue with the term heavy metal, because everybody outside of rock always thinks if you're an heavy metal band, it's like bad news. You know, everybody's like the bass player. It says sausages. You know what I mean? You get this impression that everybody's
a moron.
You can't
get more sophisticated records.
You know what I mean? It's like, as much as you...
But also, but I know you mean, because the term metal is too much of a catch-all. You know, I mean, I don't...
It is.
AC/DC weren't a metal band.
They were a blues rock band. Yeah. You know, UFO, Thin Lizzy were not heavy metal.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, were Motorhead, they had a blues influence to them. You know, pure metal. But even Judas Priest
that's kind of when the term started being...
Yeah, it just got a bit mad.
Them like made,
Queen were never a heavy metal band, but they had a couple of heavy metal songs, thanks to Brian May. And I think we were pretty much the same. It was rock, absolutely heavy rock for sure, but it wasn't Dunderhead in the sense of like...
But it was so pop on the vocal. I mean, that stuff was also beautifully huge.
You listen to our first EP, there's a song called Riding to the Sun, which is a total pop song. But then Get Your Rocks Off was a full-on rock song. But, you know, if we're heavy metal, then so are the Rolling Stones. Because it's two guitars, bass drums and a singer. Mm-hmm. It's a silly, silly term. But it should be I like rock. When you start pigeonholing, it gets on my tits, to be quite honest. Because can't we just all be just a rock band or a pop band? Or be both, but, you know.
But also, to jump ahead, you know, to Pyromania, this is the point. Because you absolutely... hammer this point here, because that's the first record. I think the really important thing about that album is this is the first time someone's made a rock record with what you'd call disco technology.
Absolutely right. You know, the first album was Tom Allom, who produced Straubs, Pat Travers, worked with Black Sabbath as an engineer.
He did your first two albums,
didn't he? No, he did the first one. Oh, first one. Great guy, lovely guy. But his kind of things that we don't know when we first sign a deal is... There's back talk between A&R men and the producer. Just capture the kind of, you know, the vibe. We don't expect the first album to do a Boston or a Van Halen. Just get what you can. And we're going in there trying to conquer the world. And he's just like, well, okay. We've been playing these songs live for 18 months. So there's no way we're in the mood to edit them down or change the lyrics or speed them up or slow them down. So we had all the backing tracks recorded in a day. Then we spent 15 days ruining it by doing too many overdubs, and then left me with 4 days to sing the bloody thing. So the first album just captured us as a diary, if you like, of what we were. Then in 1981, we worked with Mutt, who we tried to get on the first album, but he's like, no, that's not going to happen. But he came to see us open for AC/DC.
Because he'd already done Back in Black.
Yeah, he'd done Highway to Hell,
and
he'd done Back in Black. But on the Highway to Hell tour in 79, Peter Mensch, our manager, who also managed AC/DC, had said to Mutt, will you do me a favour and just watch the opening act, tell me what you think, which was us. And he said, Rough Diamond. He says, there's a lot there, but it needs a lot of polish.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare. AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and five free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out. But funnily enough, so was he at the time, because if you know, you can't compare the, what he's doing with say, you
yeah,
in with, Pyromania to what he did with Black in Black, which is, you know, quite basic.
Yeah, and if you go back before that, the he did four Boomtown Rats albums.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
He
yeah,
did
yeah,
Supercharge. Yeah. He did City Boy, 5705.
City Boy.
That
wow.
was Mott.
Do you know that song 5705 was originally called
Turn On to Jesus.
Turn On to Jesus.
Yes, yes.
Can you believe it?
And Mott was having none of that, you know. And then so how do you get around it? He said, just use numbers. It worked great for Tommy Two Tone, you know. And you know, and Roxy Music. Won the first song on the first album,
CBH 592.
It was Eno's number plate.
No, apparently it was a girl. It was a girl driving a Mini that Brian saw leaving Reading Festival.
Same thing.
we had this with Phil Manzanera, who was on last week.
Okay, brilliant.
And that 801 is 801, which take the first letter, it's Eno.
Very
clever. It was like Hal and IBM.
Conspiracy theorists are all tuning into us right now.
Especially because his dad was a spy, apparently.
Yeah, he had all of that. Go on.
Anyway, so he says Rough Diamond, we do the tour, we don't, you know, we're still hoping he'll come in. Mensch keeps tacking away, you know, chipping away at Mutt. All right, I'll do the next record, because he was between jobs or whatever. So he had us scheduled in for 3 months for High and Dry, which we recorded in Battery Studios, where they'd recorded all Highway to Hell. Most of Back in Black was done in the Bahamas, but they came back to Battery to mix it and maybe do some vocal overdubs or whatever. So our drum kit was set up where Phil Rudd's drum kit was set up. We were using Marshalls the same way that Angus and Malcolm were. Yeah. And so we were doing it in the same studio, which is why if you listen to High and Dry and listen to Highway to Hell, they kind of sound the same, even though it's two different bands. The only difference being harmonies, ballads, but one ballad. And, you know, and a bit more naivety, because AC/DC had already done six albums by the time they worked with Mutt. And he really beat us into shape. When we did a month's pre-production, which we'd never done before. And he's, you know, what riffs you got then? Let's see what you've got. And we play him stuff. He goes, that's crap.
Really?
And now I say, that's all right, but slow it right down. Huh? It sounds ploddy. Now, then double up the vocal. What vocal? I haven't got anything written. And it's like, oh, it's like going back to school. But we actually, by the time we got to the end of that record, we totally got what he was trying to
and
do.
And is that where he would get his co-writing credits?
There was no co-writing credits on the first one. On Pyromania, we all started together. So he literally was...
But it's only him and you who end up with co-writing on every song.
Well, the whole band, you know, he became like the fifth member of the writing crew, because Rick never really writes. But we would sit down if we were starting from scratch. And if he came in with an idea, we weren't going to just say, well, you're not in the band, so we can't use that. If it's a great idea, you're not going to turn it down. I mean, great example. I only found out like a month or two ago that apparently, oh, look at all the lonely people, was George Harrison.
Oh.
He suggested that to McCartney, and McCartney said, great, but you're not getting the credit. Because he'd written 98% of
right,
the song.
Right, right, right.
And he would have just said, like, McCartney Harrison, and it would have kind looked like a 50-50.
It's kind of the hook, though.
Yeah, I know. Well, this is what, according to George Harrison, this is what happened, you know. And I'm like, oh, okay. So anybody that comes in with an idea, we just thought, and by the time we got to the end of the album, it was a balanced thing. It's like, well, he didn't really do much on this one, but he did a lot more on that one. It's just make it even. So that's what we did. We just split everything, you know, 20-20.
So you're on Pyromania now. You're talking about Pyromania now.
So what we did when we sat down to do Pyromania, it was having let sink in what had happened a year before with High and Dry. He did come in with a few suggestions, a lot of suggestions, in fairness. Way more than we ever expected, but he didn't ask for a writing credit. And he would just edit more than anything else, I suppose, stuff. But when it came to Pyromania, we'd been on the road and we didn't really have any songs written. So we kind of wrote them in the pre-production room, I think No Miss maybe, for about a month. And then we had 11 backing tracks.
It's hard to remember where you were because obviously, Pyromania and Hysteria become so enormous that we only ever think of you
from that period. There's four years between that.
But so. Before then, where were Def Leppard?
On the Dole.
Right.
We were living on...
No, well, on the third... Really?
Hey, listen, this is a true story. We, after On Through the Night, which came out in April 8, 1980, we did a sold-out English tour. We first of all, before it came out, having opened for AC/DC the year before, we did a club tour up and down, literally from Aberdeen and Yeovil. We did 45 shows in 47 days or something stupid. Then the album came out, went top 20. We got to do a City Hall tour, sold out the Sheffield City Hall in 1980. Went to the States, opened for Pat Travers, opened for Priest, opened for Ted Nugent, opened for the Scorpions in Europe. Came back to start doing High and Dry in September of 1980, but Mutt was still doing Foreigner 4, which would go on till almost like end of the year. So we are now penniless, ready to make a record, having had a top 20 album, but I literally had to cut ourselves off any wages because we're out of the advance that we got from the label.
And did you have support?
I went to work on a building site for my girlfriend's father. Right. Hod carrying in the middle of January in Dronfield, in mud up to my ankles. And that's, I think it's character building. I didn't want to do it. I still wish I never did.
Did your parents say, you know what, just forget the band?
No, they never did. No, they were fair.
Or were they happy that you'd got a proper job?
Yeah, they probably were happy that I got a proper job. But it was the middle of winter. It was horrible. We were still working as a band in the evening, rehearsing and trying to write songs. Right, yeah. And then when we started doing High and Dry, we had to go down to London and we're staying in bedsits.
You've still got a deal. You're skinny.
Oh, yeah, we've got a
six-album
deal. But because we had to cut the money down, on the 30 quid a week went down to 15 or whatever, and it's like I was getting paid more in the factory. And so you're having one pint, four straws in the pub, you know. You know, I look back at it now with a sort of affection.
It's so cinematic, though, isn't it? Because you can't write it better than that.
It's nuts. So we get into the studio to do High and Dry. I know everything's back to normal then, because once we're in the studio, the record company turned the tap back on a bit. Not a great deal, but enough to feed us, because we're all having to live in London anyway, which is not cheap. Mm-mm. And we're probably all in a bedsit.
Yeah, where are you in London?
I move to London. A friend of mine called Frank Noon, who was in a band from Grantham. Peter's brother, exactly. Who played on our first EP, because Tony, the original drummer, we kind of parted company about a week before the first EP. Because he wanted to take his girlfriend to the pictures instead of rehearse. We went, that's not commitment.
My God.
So we borrowed Frank.
Oh, my God, the twists are turned. Is.
We borrowed this guy.
What was the movie, though?
Yeah, it might be worth it, yeah.
We borrowed Frank for the week. He rehearsed with us after that. So we couldn't even start rehearsing until 11 at night because he was rehearsing with his band. So we do 11 till 1 a.m. and then go home after walks, no buses, from town all the way back to Broomhill. You get home at 3 and get up at 7 and go to work. It was nuts, but you're young, it doesn't matter.
Exactly.
So we borrow him, we get through the EP, and then Rick Allen joins literally about 2 days after that because we put an advert in the paper. Actually, we didn't. We couldn't afford to take the ad out in the back going, band needs drummer. We asked Keith Strong, who was the pop page on Thursdays, to put it in as an article so it'd be free.
Oh, in the local paper?
Oh, yeah, we were smart. In the middle of summer of 1981, I moved to Isleworth, where Frank Noon had moved, and it was frat house. It was Animal House. It was a basement in Grove Road in this big sink. It was a detached house with a great big back garden. And the basement flat became free. So my mum and dad had gone on holiday, and I left them this like tear-stained letter saying, "Mum and Dad, I've left home." And I'd packed my few belongings and legged it down to London. I don't even know how I got there.
Like Dick Whittington.
Yeah, it was stick over the shoulder with a knotted handkerchief. And I moved into
There's Paul with a handkerchief.
I moved into this apartment, and lo and behold, I'm in 10A, and 10B was Bernie Torme, who worked with Gillan and Ozzy Osbourne, and he had his own band, which
with
Frank
Phil Spaulding playing bass. That's right.
Yeah, it's crazy. And so it was like total frat house. So I was living there till all the way through the recording of Iron Dry, then all the way through the American tour and the European tour for that album. And then in January of 83, we started working on Pyromania, and we worked on that album all the way through till about December.
I thought it came out in January 83.
It did. I'm saying we were still doing mixes up to Christmas yet. The album came out 4 weeks later. They can't do that now. They could do it 40 years ago.
But what was the difference? Was Mutt in a very different place?
Yeah.
Because the whole approach was
By 1982, unique. As you well know, music is what it is. There's traditionalists still doing what they do. Yeah. But then you've got New Order. You've got the Human League who've been doing their thing for two years. And you can either... And it's like, wow, this is like massively in time. It's a machine. You know, and the synthesizers, and basically a kind of a rocked up version of Kraftwerk's Autobahn.
And also, with Trevor, there was more of an emphasis.
Well, we hadn't even heard of Trevor on then, really.
Because you did it real. You're using a Lynn machine, a Lynn drum machine for your click track.
Yeah.
And you actually, this is actually more Trevor than Trevor. You did the drums last.
Yeah. I knew Buggles, but I didn't know what Trevor Horn was going to become.
Yeah.
By 1984, with Grace Jones, Slave to the Rhythm, one of the greatest things ever made. Yeah. Frankie goes to Hollywood stuff.
I suppose 82 he was doing Dollar and...
Yeah, of course, which I didn't actually... I forgot about that. Yeah, I mean, those
ABC.
Things,
ABC.
He was like the Stock, Aitken and Waterman of the cool club, wasn't he?
But Mutt must have thought, you know what, actually, I think I can do things differently.
Yeah, he approached us when we got together, having not seen him for the 9 months we were on the road. It was like this. Hey, how you doing? Coffee, water... Chatting, I've been doing this, I've been doing that. How have you lot been? Oh, it's a good tour, blah, blah, blah. So, what are we going to do? And it was basically what he said was something along the lines of, are we going to make High and Dry 2, or are we going to make an album that nobody's ever made before? Wow. And we were like totally, somebody says that to you, you're a kid, you're like going, I'll go for the second one, please, sir. So, he said, it's going to be a bit weird, because even he didn't know what he was doing. He seriously wanted to do this, but it was he'd never done it before, so it was a total experiment. We played to a click track. Mm-mm. We did all the guitars, which had its advantages, because when Mutt says to at the time it would have been Steve and Pete, I want you to go like this. It's a lot easier to do it if there's nothing behind you dictating how far you go. So you make it a guitar thing rather than just following what the drums are doing. And it was the same thing when it came to writing vocals. If you put the backing track down and you've not got any vocals written yet, the drummer will tend to just say, well, there's a hole there, put a big fill in it, and then that fills in the way of a really cool line, like, I want to touch you.
Because you were writing at the same time as recording.
But there's a flip side to that, which is, do you think, especially with like some of the kind of riffs you guys have got, laying a guitar down properly when there's no proper drums is probably hard.
It's hard, yeah.
What were the drums? What were you playing to? Was it literally just a click? Just a little Lynn, yeah.
Kind of, it's a little bit less basic than that, but not far off that. So, and I totally get the fact that when a band in the 60s, the Beatles, the Stones, the Kinks, the Who, blah, 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 when they went in, their songs were written, rehearsed, and they had to bang them out in 20 minutes. So it was all... They'd have got rid of all that stuff in rehearsal, in when they were writing it. But we were writing as we went along. We put the music together, as you know, with rock. It's fours, it's eights, it's sixteens. It's mathematically simple. It's not jazz. So you write, well, this will be a verse. Now it needs to be into a bridge. Then it needs to go into a chorus, and then a middle eight.
So it was instrumental before you came along.
Totally.
The top line.
When they'd spend maybe 4 or 5 months doing guitars and stuff like that, and I would nibble away at lyrics, but essentially, we didn't even start doing vocals until the 11 backing tracks were done. And
so sometimes those backing tracks didn't even have a melody.
No, they Mutt had me or Mutt or even, you know, even Sav would say, oh, I've got a great idea for this bit. But it's like, yeah, we'll deal with that later on. So we were literally writing, like you might write the music and then come up with a lyric.
People do that all the time now. The top line person comes in and someone will play them the beats and the grooves. Yeah. And the...
But it's not very often that we've ever put poetry to music, if you know what I mean. It's always been the other way. We've written... Right. This is a moody, deep song with a minor chord. Like, we're not going to write lyric.
Has there never been a time you've come and gone, hey, guys, I got this?
Yeah, so Too Late for Love off Pyromania. Right. I actually did have the lyrics totally finished, except for the chorus, which didn't matter because it's just as long as it tied in lyrically, we could come up with that later on. So we would, me and Mutt, summertime, by the time we got most of the backing tracks done, we'd take a song per day and sit down and say, right, what you got? And get our books out and start, you know, lines that we'd stolen from a movie, anything that we thought was cool. Mm-hmm. And we would start building stuff up. And Die Hard the Hunter is another one where I had the lyrics all written out. Yeah. I think I'd watched First Blood, and it was pretty much based on the character of Rambo. You know, the kid coming from a war, Vietnam, Korea, or whatever. And he's like still going off in his head, so he takes it out on his neighborhood. Which I thought was clever at the time. Now it's a bit cliched, but you know, at the time.
Well, it wasn't at the time. It was new.
So I had that. But things like Photograph, for example, came about once we had this song. We knew from a musical point of view, this is really special. Yeah. And you just don't ruin it now. And my apartment in basement flat in Isleworth, the previous tenant, obviously on a drunken rampage one night, had punched a hole through the bathroom wall. So it looked like the Shawshank Redemption, you know? So I put a poster of Marilyn Monroe over the hole because I'm not going to fix, not my place, I'm renting it, you know? You go to the Jacks and you're staring at this thing every day. And when we came to the idea of Photograph, I said, how about we write it like Pictures of Lily, where it's about this girl that you're madly in love with and then your dad taps you on the shoulder and goes, sorry, son, but she's like dead. And so the ultimate want you can never have. And that just... You know, that rang a chord. But
everything about that song...
We got it right.
That was the song, really. That was the thing that changed your life.
It seriously was. When we ran out of money, or we thought... Mutt was very sensible. He said, we can't stay in Battery Studios making this record. Once we got the basics done, we've got to go somewhere else. So we went down to Battle, where Wings used to record. It's just outside Hastings. It's probably where the battle actually happened.
That's why it's called Battle.
Uh-huh. And it's a farmhouse living, a quarter of the price of Battery Studios. And we were in there. I remember being in a room like this. It was like the rec room. The telly's on, there's cricket on because it's summertime. And we heard, they'd been messing about trying to get an intro for this song. We had most of the song. We didn't have a great intro. And then sooner, you know, one afternoon, we just heard this. And everybody that wasn't in the control room just went.
Was it Phil?
No, Phil wasn't in the band by then.
Still wasn't in the band.
It was Steve and Pete. And we all just went like this and went running into the control room. And Mutt just turned around and went, well, must be good. Got their attention. It's like, that's incredible. You know, we've hit our more than a feeling moment, if you like, you know.
Right.
And we just knew there was just something about that one song. The others were fine, but this had that flagship thing about it. Like, you know, Bankman Turner Overdrive had it. You ain't seen nothing yet. Golden Earring had it with Radar Love. Argent had it with God Gave Rock and Roll to You and Hold Your Head Up. You know, you have that one song that's just better than the other nine, you know, with Argent, probably the other four.
All of them, actually.
You know, 20-minute long epics, you know. Yeah. And so, and they're also written by Russ Ballard, which probably helped. We just knew, you know, so it's like, it was a case of just don't mess it up now, you know. So you're more on your metal about it as well. You just... With the other ones, it's like, that'll be great. Actually Not Words is a throwaway wannabe Rolling Stones song. Sung that way, written that way, you know. Mm. Kind of like Start Me Up, but just a massive failure, really, in comparison. But with Photograph, we knew this is big.
And it was perfect for FM radio in America.
It was. Sadly, it didn't happen in the UK because it stalled at 41.
Unbelievable.
Which means he didn't get that Saturday afternoon top 40 place, which could have taken
it. But was it Radio 1 playlisted?
Not really.
It's strange, it didn't actually, I don't think it made the top 10 in America though, did it? The album though becomes the biggest album.
Yeah.
It was a
compilation of mini hits. I think it got to number 12 or 11.
I think what it proved is actually coming at a time when kids were buying singles, the people that liked your music went straight out and bought the album.
If you,
as I say, look, America, you always tend to judge things by albums anyway, don't you?
In fairness, in the UK as well, I've got a mate that sends me charts from the 70s about once a week going, look at this. And you're looking at Rebel Rebel, which peaks at number 14.
Yeah.
Heroes, 25.
Yeah. Who never had a number one.
You know what I mean? Heroes at 25 blew my mind.
That's right. But I think the thing is different. This is the difference between, because in over here, we have Radio 1, which sells singles. In America, you have FM radio, which sells albums.
That's exactly what happened. It's right place at right time. It was also, what was a massive contributing factor was they had in America, which we didn't have for six years in Europe, was MTV. Right. It started off...
Was it that long?
It started off really slowly by being picked up on a few satellite backwater channels in backwater towns. Mm-mm-mm. And eventually, by 1982, middle of 1982, it had started, it was on every cable company's roster of channels, was MTV. And for the first time ever, kids got a 24-hour channel where they could watch videos.
Yeah, I remember when we toured in America, we were successful in the states that had MTV, and then zero
everywhere else
that weren't.
And so what you started getting was, they had 400 videos when they opened up, and Buggles was the first one they ever played because of the title of the song. But they had the promo videos that we'd made for High and Dry, which included Bring On The Heartbreak, which was a kind of a crossover ballady rock thing. And he started getting a lot of play, and then he started getting requests, and then he started getting requested on radio, and then more and more radio and MTV kind of, somebody see it and request it on the radio, somebody hear it on the radio and request it on MTV. It just took off. And while we're making Pyromania, High and Dry goes gold. An album that was at 200,000 is now over 600,000 as we release Pyromania. David Mallet makes the video for Photograph and for Rock of Ages. Overblown colours. It's like a Percy lad. You know, everything's whiter than white and bluer than blue and redder than red. And all shot in Battersea Power Station, your mate's front cover of Animals. And I remember we did the Photograph video on Phil's birthday, 2nd of December. We did the Rock of Ages on the 8th of December. Sav's birthday for Photograph, Phil's birthday for Rock of Ages. And so we had these videos in the can. The album comes out, Photograph doesn't take off in the UK, but goes through the roof in the States. But as you say, it wasn't like a number one hit single, number one airplay for months on rock radio. But I think on the Billboard 200, it probably peaked at 11. Rock of Ages didn't even get that high, neither did Fooling, but they were massively played on all the stations that mattered, which put our album behind Thriller for six months.
Yeah.
Couldn't move him.
Just briefly on the kind of strange moment also in Pyromania when Phil comes in and you change guitarists.
He joined us on the day of the World Cup final in 1982. I'd never forget it because we were watching it at Peter Mench's house waiting for him to come round. We had to drive Pete Willis down from Sheffield. What a job for our drum tech. He's in the car for 162 miles on the M1 with a guitarist next to him. He's basically going to the guillotine. You know what I mean?
He knew that.
Pete knew, because we'd sent him home to sober up, but he's like, he'd been given 1,000 chances, and we went, you just can't do this anymore. He knew it was coming, but we didn't want to just telex him.
You finished all the basic tracks with him already.
Yeah, we finished all the basic tracks. And I will say this about Pete. He was a phenomenal rhythm player. His right hand was a metronome. Absolutely brilliant, you know, but it was... You know, he just had a bit of an issue with things. So we just didn't want to go on it. I'd known Phil since, Christ, Girl opened for UFO and a bunch of people. He stayed at my mum and dad's house when their hotel was too far away in Sheffield.
So you knew all the girl guys.
Oh, yeah.
So you knew Jerry Laffey.
I knew Jerry. Knew him all.
Who taught me my first chords on the guitar.
No way.
Because he was my sister's boyfriend.
Fantastic. Yeah, I mean, you know, when I met Phil, I met all of them, you know. It was... We used to mess about before, 2 years before he joined us. He said we should plant stories in the press about hating each other and just start a war for a laugh. It never really happened because the press got wind of the fact we were going to try and do it. But I'd stay at his mom's place in Walthamstow, and he would stay with me in Sheffield whenever they were playing. And I remember we went to a nightclub in Sheffield once, me, Phil Lewis, Steve Clark and Phil. And so we had a guitarist, a singer and a singer. Steve Clark went on bass, I went on drums, and we went on the gear of this metal band, sorry to use that phrase, a hard rock band called Sledgehammer. who'd played the Genevieve. That's a metal in band. Sheffield. And we asked if you could borrow their gear, and we got up on and did Do You Love Me by Kiss, and you really got me. And Steve fell asleep on the drum riser playing the bass because he was so bollocks drunk. It was just funny.
But what Phil brings in is he comes in and does all the icing on the cake.
Yeah, right? Phil comes in with the glam vibe. Yeah. He was not... He
and the pecs, the blues. Let's not make any bones.
Well, yeah, but they came kind of later on. But what Pete Willis had a kind of a Pat Travers-y, Robin Trower-ness about him. Mm-hmm. Phil had a heavy metal kid's...
Yes, yeah,
right.
Yeah, glam, yeah, you know, big fan of John McLaughlin, big fan of Richie Blackmore, big fan of Eddie Van Halen, but loved Sweet, loved Queen, loved Brian May.
Yeah, but also had a real modern 80s feel.
Yeah,
to
and it was totally, you know, the thing that a band like us needed is an 80s touch rather than a 70s thing in the 80s. Yeah. We wanted something
that's
that was
a precision,
bit more
that kind of
metal pick. I mean, the guy, the sound is like, I'm deaf in this ear because of him. You know, it just brought a totally new dynamic to the band and freshened everything up, because as much as he could drink for the Olympic squad, he didn't get mean when he drank. He was funny, you know, and
buzz-eyed. You just had a good work ethic, didn't you, all of you?
But, yeah,
you
always.
Know, we should, the reason you came in as well is because you it's the 40th anniversary. 40-ish anniversary.
41st.
And there's this box set that you've executive produced.
Mm. Right, well, you can skip the first disc because you've heard it for 40 years.
Right, okay.
It's a remastered, again, version of the first 10.
Remastered.
Yeah, yeah. As you may remember, I've been saying the 11 backing tracks that we did. Along the way, an 11th backing track got abandoned. We recorded enough of it for it to be a song, but we didn't think enough of it to finish it. And I also think it was probably swayed, that decision was swayed by the fact that you're still in vinyl land in 1982. Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, five songs each side is the balance. So this 11th song can be a B-side. It's like, we've been so long making this record. It's like, forget it. We'll do it for the next album. And then we just forgot it existed. Then during COVID, I'm cleaning out my tape library, going through all these cassettes that've got nothing written on them. And then,
I remember that's the TDK.
Yeah. And then you put them on, and just because, I don't know, you think you're an idiot to do it, but then you're glad you're not. It's blank. You put it in, and you can't hear anything. So you fast forward it 2 minutes, and there's still nothing. Fast forward it to 22 minutes, and you can hear a bit of hiss. And then you fast forward it again, and it's halfway through a song that's in the middle of the tape. Why? Why? You know what I mean? So, and then you
tape up left
and right. This is that 11th song. And it's not even the recording of it, it's a demo. It's a band playing, with a real kit.
Actually, what's interesting about it, because we've heard it, is that it's almost open for other kids to who want to do a melody on it now.
Oh,
isn't
totally!
It?
They're all instrumental, because as I said, we don't bother writing the lyrics until we get a song. Okay, Mutt says we're going to do it. We're going to do it. You know, so there's six demos that I'd found. You know, again on a blank tape. And it's like, I transferred them into digital and sent them to Sav. I said, do you remember these? And he goes, yeah, they're pre-Paramania demos that they just got abandoned because the other ones were better. We had 16, 17 things knocking about. The 11th song, we found the multitracks in the archives at Universal.
Oh, great.
So they copied them onto digital, sent them to Ronan, our sound guy, who mixed it sympathetically to sound like 1983. So there's a real proper version of the backing track of, apparently the song was called No, You Can't Do That, which none of us ever, that's what was written on the box. But that line was stolen and used in the song Die Hard the Hunter. So obviously we'd like a phrase well, we're going to use that somewhere else if I'm going to finish that song. And he went into the bridge. And so that's on the disc with the rough mixes that I found on a cassette, all brilliantly tidied up by Ronan McHugh, our sound guru. Get dehissed and made to sound glorious, and so there's instrumental versions, half finished vocals. It's just a mishmash of history, is what it is. And then there's the live recording from the LA Forum when Brian May got up with us on the second. He came to watch the first night, and we were hanging out with him backstage because he turns out he's a fan, and like we're going, this Brian May from Queen, holy God! And he says, can I get up and play with you guys tomorrow? And we're like,
so he asked you.
He comes down and he brings his Vox amp. And
what song did he play?
We're stood at the desk watching him, and he starts playing Photograph.
Oh my God!
And we're like, So it's too difficult to work him into that one. So we encored with Creedence's Traveling Band, 12 bar whip round song, you know. And he says, yeah, I know that one enough. We sound checked it with him and boom, we did this phenomenal version and so that's on the live thing. There's a live recording that's never seen the light of day legally from Germany in 1983.
Oh, the Westfalenhalle.
Yes,
I did that. Is that a TV show?
Yes,
yes,
we did that. We have a tape of that somewhere.
It was a funny night because there was a rock night, there was a pop night, and there's a moment I'll never forget. Sat in the bar with Steve Harris from Iron Maiden and Nick Beggs from Kajagoogoo, just having a pint.
Well, we did ours. The night we did ours, you two were on. That's how weird it was.
We did it with Simple Minds, The Pretenders, and a load of, yeah.
As Ice House.
As Ice House, yeah.
Wow, you were in Ice House?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
That was my first proper band.
I love that Joe knows everything about music apart from the fact he was in Ice House.
Well, now you know that.
Yeah, wow.
That was the last thing.
Loved Ice House.
Wow. Oh, there you go.
Fantastic.
And there's a booklet.
Oh, the book's brilliant. In fact, you probably got them. Quadrophenia, Tommy, all the good stuff. You buy it for the book.
Yeah.
Because it's a 200-page read while you're listening to the demos and stuff like that. I hate it when it's like the petrol station album. You know, the greatest hits of Otis Redding, and it's just a picture of Otis Redding and the song titles on the back.
Yeah.
I just burn it into my thing and throw this disc away. I want to read the history.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and so that's what you've got. It's great unused photos, brand new interviews. It's not archive stuff.
No, I agree. You can't have enough of that, especially with the old stuff.
We are quality control. We do it ourselves. We don't just say, if you want to put it out, piece it. That's why I got the credit. I didn't ask for it. They gave it to me generously because I literally spent months, in fact, years, piecing this thing together because I had all the stuff.
Every time I look at your Instagram, you were on the road in some stadium. Unbelievable amount of shows you've been doing. Unbelievable. God, how successful it's been for you. And now you're going on to do a load more with some other, with Foreigner? Journey, and Steve
Miller is opening for us as well.
I've got a big question about this because there's an interview I saw, which I think it's very interesting that you never, to paraphrase Captain Willard, you never get off the bus.
Well, I didn't in 2022 because of the, you know, it was still post COVID.
Okay.
And I, you know, everybody's like,
has a bus,
you know,
never goes to
Dylan
the hotel.
Never goes to the hotel. I didn't then. I do now. I'm back to normal again. But he's like, go and touch the elevator buttons, you wear gloves. And like, this is bollocks.
You're worried about your voice.
You know, and it's exactly, with COVID, you can play the drums, you can play the guitar, you cannot sing. So I said, I'm living on my bus. So I got a bus with a loo, a shower, a kitchen.
Were you like ET?
Were you like
that last scene of ET when he was behind all the plastic?
No, I wasn't avoiding the bubble. But I just thought this would be a good laugh, you know, because I don't mind being isolated. We took bunks out. I put a Peloton on the bike.
That's right.
So I ride the Peloton to Power Age by AC/DC because it's perfect.
I love the Peloton.
Except for Riff Raff, it'd give you a heart attack.
I love the Peloton. Mate, actually, they should be advertising through us. That's a good idea.
So I had a double bed. It was brilliant. It was a proper, you know, mattress, telly, Netflix. And I just spent all my time like eating healthy food, riding the Peloton, getting off the bus, doing the gig. Seeing the guys in the dressing room, so you don't see them too much, you know, getting on each other's nerves, and just having a laugh, and then going, "That was great," and then get back on my bus, and I would sleep on the bus outside the hotel.
So you still get on?
Brilliant.
So you still go on?
Oh, yeah, it was brilliant.
It wasn't like Metallica having to stay in separate countries.
No, it was just because I didn't want to blow it. You know, we'd waited all this time.
That's
new album out. I didn't want it to be like Aerosmith, three shows into their tour, and they cancel because Stephen loses his voice.
We're being nudged because you have to go, apparently. But you've got Journey as well.
Journey,
that's
Steve
an amazing
Miller
ticket, I have to say.
It's about 26 shows. I think Stephen was on 18, Heart are on 4, and Cheap Trick are on 4.
Cheap Trick.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, last time we went out, it was us last time we went out with Journey, we had The Pretenders, we had Cheap Trick. It was brilliant. It's like a mini festival. When we're not, Motley Crue is the same thing.
Do you always top the bill?
And joined Joan Jett. I mean, she's in the Hall of Fame, and she was going up for an hour at 6 o'clock at night.
Do you always top the bill?
Oh, yeah. We do on this tour. We flip-flopped with Motley, but we're topping the bill on this tour,
Are you going to come to Europe and England?
Well, we just did the Britain, UK. Yeah, you were invited to Wembley, but you didn't turn up, remember?
There was a reason.
But I did see Steve in Blackpool. We played the beach in Blackpool and Steve Norman turned up.
How was he?
He was great. He was doing some writing session with some guy.
And but are you not doing this tour?
No, we played Wembley, we played Ibrox, and we did Marley Park in Dublin. And this beach, it was freezing. It was July, August, and it was absolutely no July. It was freezing cold.
I think we were away.
But you live in Ireland, so you
were away. No, I'm just joking. You were away.
Our own tour.
But it's brilliant. You know, we sold out Wembley. It was great. You can't do that 2 years in a row. It wouldn't work. We're not exactly Queen or U2. No. So to do it maybe every 3 or 4 years. I think that the next time we play the UK will be maybe festivals, either next summer or the summer after.
Chad, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. I'd stay here all day.
Oh, mate.
We never even got to, like, when we lived in Dublin. No, and we hang out at the pool.
They want to listen. You know? They can go back to that. But we can always talk about it again and again.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No. We'll open a permanent channel, I think.
Yeah. Well, mates for life. I mean, you've got to remember that Keeble, me, Sav and Steve and your brother had the best five-a-side team in Dublin.
Yeah.
You know,
I wasn't in the team, obviously.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. I like football, but I can't play.
Yeah, no, Marty was
great.
Were you
their sort of poet laureate?
Yeah.
we won a tin of beans in a five-a-side tournament against Dermot Morgan, you know, Father Ted.
Right. Yeah.
We had Tony Curry and they had Johnny Giles playing for him. It was brilliant.
They were great days, weren't they?
Yeah, it was great fun. Us,
unbelievable.
Us, Spandau and Frankie's and Terence Trent D'Arby occasionally.
Yeah.
And I often say this, we probably wouldn't have spoke to each other if we'd have met in London. But because we were expats outside, you know, it was not exactly in the Middle East, but, you know, we were in Ireland.
That's right.
There's something about, like, you're English, you're British, you're in Ireland. It's like, hello, mate, how are you?
And you were working-class blokes from Sheffield, from Liverpool, and from London.
You vacated one house, we moved in. Yeah. You know, that kind of thing on in Bowles Bridge where you guys lived?
Of course.
Which became the Norwegian embassy, I think, afterwards. It's hilarious, you know.
Is that a euphemism for the Norwegian embassy?
No, it really was. Yeah.
Joe, we've got to wrap up. Thank you so much, mate. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Really, absolutely. Really you'll be on for part three at some stage, definitely.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Cheers. I could go on talking to Joe Elliott forever.
It was funny because you actually don't need to do any research at all, do you? You just need to know that he's made an album.
Yeah,
and it was called something.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? And then he kind of does the rest.
I was
just going, I just can't get in. There's so much, all this info. I can't find the information. I can't. No, you just don't need any of it.
You don't need any of it. No, he's the oracle on pop and rock from mostly the 70s, obviously, and the 80s.
Yeah,
that's what he's so great at. And I mean, it was just one of those chats where I could have, you know, said, right, let's go off to a restaurant. Let's ended up talking forever. But
that's right.
But the powers that be kicked him off.
Yeah, I know the man.
The man. anyway, we've got someone else on next week.
So, thanks to everyone. Thanks for the production team here, to Ben.
Yeah, for producing it. Then we're all down at Warner today.
We're at Warner's today,
Thank you to those guys who've worked here and just made a little film of it all as well.
Yeah. And so, in fact, I would say, seeing as we're at Warner Brothers, I think the way we should end it is... That's all, folks.
Rockanteurs is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.